Good morning. My name is Dr. Scott McLeod. I'm director of CASEL, the only university center in the country that's dedicated to the technology leadership needs of school administrators. As Bob Dylan noted, the times they are a-changin'. The world we currently live in and the world our students are going to live in is nothing like the world of just a decade or two ago. Now, of course, this has always been true. Change is a constant. But the shifts that we've been seeing in society of late are quite large. Some folks have been calling them seismic. Together, they add up to something radically different than we've seen before. For example, our schools look a lot different than they used to. They're more colorful, they're more diverse, they're more ethnically and linguistically rich. When I was born in 1968, 80% of the American school population was white. Today, just over half of the population is white. You can see that our percentage of Hispanics has quadrupled from 5% to nearly 20%. Percentage of Asians has increased from 1% to 4%. Our schools look a lot different inside than they used to. As the Did You Know video points out, digital technologies have arrived to stay. They're also changing and changing us at an unbelievably rapid pace. For nearly all of us, the internet is really less than a decade old. And yet, it is also indispensable to nearly all of us. If we try to imagine the world 10 years out or 20 or 30, it appears quite clear that we have no idea what it's going to look like on many fronts. As Kramer notes, we're cramming an entire societal shift into about a decade and a half so far. This is societal change at an unprecedented pace, and it's quite unsettling for many people. We now live in an interconnected world. Many nations, economies, and cultures are now intertwined and interdependent. They're interdependent economically, meaning that if one country's economy suffers, the ripple effects typically are felt across the globe and often are quite major. Cultures also are intertwined. We see the sharing of cultural influences between different countries, even countries that are geographically distant from each other. Of course, the United States is both a cultural exporter and a cultural importer. Technology is allowing us to bridge issues of geography and time. It's no longer a barrier to be geographically remote. We're no longer protected or insulated because of geographic distance. In this new world, anyone that has an internet connection and a little bit of knowledge can participate. We are all interconnected at the country level, at the corporate or organizational level, at the individual level. The technology is also allowing nations and regions to leapfrog over others. Countries such as India and South Korea and China and Singapore and Australia and Finland are seeing that strategic investments in digital technologies can pay off quite handsomely in the new global economy. Leapfrogging infrastructures is also occurring. So, for example, countries with little or no telephone infrastructure, they're not running telephone poles and wires out to the remote regions. They simply jump immediately to cellular telephony, which is cheaper and requires less maintenance than the old system. They're not digging trenches in the dirt for cable and internet access. They simply jump to satellite and so on. The new WiMAX technology that's being piloted by Intel right now allows the placement of wireless towers every 25 to 30 miles instead of every few hundred feet. So we can easily imagine a scenario in the not too distant future in which our state of Minnesota could be blanketed with a few hundred WiMAX towers, thus enabling wireless internet access everywhere you went, even in the boundary waters in your canoe. Now, whether you should do that is another issue. But you could do that. One of the things we're also seeing is that other countries have more centralized systems, which allows them to be more directive, right? We're so decentralized. We have 50 states. We have, 14,000 school districts. It's very hard to sort of mobilize everybody in a common direction, whereas some of these other countries where they're more autocratic and have more centralized systems, they're able to just push down from above and make things happen countrywide. Some of them also have a greater sense of urgency. We've enjoyed our place at the top for quite a while. The countries who are trying to play catch-up, they have a sense of urgency in that mission. So I'm not sure that we can afford to be complacent. I'm not a global alarmist, but we do have to recognize that we're no longer going to enjoy our position as the sole superpower of the world, and that other countries are coming and working with us, and they're competing for global talent. So I don't know how many of you have read The World is Flat. A few of you, okay? So Friedman talks very much about this flattening of the world and the fact that the technology allows us to work with India as if it was literally next door nowadays. Western industrialized societies are getting older. In America, we currently have 3 times as many people who are age 65 or older than we did a century ago. So 12% now, 4% at the turn of the last century. By 2020, we will have 4 times as many people who are age 65 as we did in 1900. And by 2030, we'll have 5 times as many. By 2030, there's going to be about twice as many retirees as we have now, but only 18% more workers. We got 77 million baby boomers that are retiring. And we don't really know what it means to have a society in which a fifth of our population is made up of what we used to call senior citizens. Folks who no longer in the twilight of their lives, but now can reasonably expect to live for another 2 to 4 decades in pretty decent health. And of course, we're going to start to see some competing political interests between this generation and the generations that follow them. Because for the baby boomer generation and the folks who are older, neither education nor technology is generally high on their list of interests and concerns. In fact, many people in that generation are currently in charge of things. They're in charge of our governments. They're in charge of our school organizations. But they don't really get this technology stuff, for example, very well. And that's not meant in a pejorative sense. They just didn't grow up with it. They're not, you know, immersed in it like the kids today are, like the young adults of today are. So they're not very technology savvy. They're not very technology knowledgeable. And yet they're in positions where they're making decisions and crafting policy about the very things that they don't understand. They have less of a connection to schools. They have a less of a connection to the technological world, which is causing vast societal upheavals around the globe. And their interests are centering around issues related to sort of their life phase, healthcare, retirement, Social Security, maybe starting a completely new career. These folks also have different views of work and education and life, which I'm going to talk about now. How many of you have read Rise of the Creative Class? Anybody? One? Two? Awesome. Richard Florida, who's a noted demographer, was at Carnegie Mellon. I can't remember where he left. Somewhere, he's in California now, I think. He's noted that we're making a transition from an agricultural age where the focus was on land and human labor to an industrial age where the focus was on raw materials and physical labor and machine labor to a technological age where the focus is on human intelligence and knowledge and creativity. And the creative class, the people who are paid principally to do creative work for a living, that would be you and me, among others, that percentage of our working population has grown drastically since the 1900s. So in 1900, less than 10% of people got to be creative in their work lives. And by 1975, you can see that was up to almost 20%, and then personal computers hit. And we've seen a drastic acceleration up so that in just the last quarter century, we're now up to 30% and climbing. The creative class are the folks in science and engineering, architecture and design, education, art, music, entertainment. Their economic function is to create new ideas, new technologies, new creative content. This also includes sort of a broader group of creative professionals like business and finance and law and healthcare, people who engage in complex problem solving that involves a great deal of independent judgment and requires high levels of education or human capital. And both of these groups share a common creative ethos that values creativity and individuality and difference and merit. Contrast the creative class with the working class, which is manufacturing and construction and transportation, or the service class, which is sort of personal care, food service, clerical work. And of course, we still have a couple of percentage points of folks who are involved in agriculture. The working and service classes are primarily paid to execute according to plan, while the creative class is primarily paid to create and have considerably more autonomy and flexibility. The creative sector right now represents about 38 million Americans, and they earn twice as much on average as folks in the working class or the service class. And even though they're only about 30%, maybe a little over 30% of our working population, they account for over half of all wage and salary income in our country. In other words, they're making as much as the manufacturing and service sectors combined. They're more satisfied with their jobs than folks in the other sectors. They find those jobs more personally and professionally fulfilling. They're the kind of jobs we want our kids and grandkids to have. This new employee of today has very different beliefs about work and the workplace than the generations that preceded them, the baby boomers and their parents. have different beliefs than the folks who are working now. The folks who are out there working today now, they value individuality. They value self-expression. They value openness to difference over the homogeneity and the conformity and sort of the fitting in that defined the organization age of the 50s and 60s. Folks are striving to work more independently, and they're finding it much harder to cope with incompetent managers and bullying bosses. Job mobility and geographic mobility is way up, way up. And we're basically trading job security for autonomy. Right? In addition to being paid and treated fairly, we want the ability to learn and grow in our jobs. We want the ability to shape the content of our work. We want the ability to control our own schedules, maybe include even working at home and telecommuting sometimes. And we want the ability to express our own identities through our work. And we're willing to move and leave to obtain that. We're increasingly demanding a lifestyle at home as well, around the creative experiences. And of course, this shift is causing massive tensions and disruptions. Working class jobs, some service class jobs, they're going overseas because other places will pay those folks less. So it's economically rational for many corporations. We've got outsourcing issues. We've got global competition for manufacturing issues because of the lower wages and lower benefits. We're also seeing inroads into the creative class. Daniel Pink, author of A Whole New Mind. I know Lisa has read this. Who else? Anybody else read this? Yeah, okay. Talks about the importance of creativity. He says, ask yourself three questions about your job. Number one, can somebody overseas do it cheaper? Number two, can a computer do it faster? And number three, is what I'm offering in demand in an age of abundance? I see some of you writing. I've neglected to tell you that you'll be able to get all this later, so don't feel like you have to capture it. And Pink says that if your answer to number one or two is yes, or your answer to number three is no, you're in trouble in terms of your job and your whole job category, basically, not just you personally. And that what we're seeing is we're seeing an increased emphasis and need for people who can forge relationships rather than execute transactions, for people who are able to tackle novel, complex challenges instead of solving routine problems, who are able to synthesize and connect disparate parts, thus creating or adding value to existing resources, the capacity to detect patterns and opportunities, to combine seemingly unrelated ideas into something new, to craft a satisfying narrative, to create artistic and emotional beauty. These are the resources, the economic resources, that are necessary to survive and thrive in the new economy that we're living in now. As we've moved from the agricultural age to the industrial age to the information age, our primary economic resource is no longer raw materials from the ground or human labor. Our primary and most lucrative raw material now is information and creativity. So the question, of course, becomes, are schools focusing on the right things? We need to ask ourselves, does the work that our students do in our classrooms on a regular basis reflect this burgeoning movement towards autonomy and creativity? And David Warlick says, we may not survive without a generation of young people who are imaginative, inventive, fearless learners, compassionate leaders. And yet, what can we say as educators about the students that we're producing? We can prove that they can read, do basic math on paper, and they're able to sit for hours filling in bubble sheets. No generation in history has ever been so thoroughly prepared for the industrial age. Lest you think it's just the education blogosphere that's up in arms about the new economy, we have a variety of other entities that are out there talking about these issues. The National Center on Education and the Economy fostered the new Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce. Some of you may have seen this report, The Tough Choices or Tough Times, where they highlight in quite drastic terms sort of the shift that our economy and the global workplace has made over the past few years. Now, they're a little more alarmist than I am, but nonetheless, there's some very good stuff in that report. The Partnership for 21st Century Skills, how many of you are familiar with them? A few of you, okay. Where they're trying to figure out what does it mean, what do kids need to know and be able to do in this new environment. And of course, there's the core subjects, the stuff that we're assessing now through No Child Left Behind and other accountability efforts. But then there's all the other stuff that's also out there that we need to hit. Things like learning and thinking skills, technology literacy, global awareness, problem solving, communication skills, innovation, collaboration. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of, as we expand our thinking about what it means to be a well-prepared student and a well-prepared worker, how do we assess those things? right? We need to come up with new models of assessment around how do we assess creativity? How do we assess innovation? How do we assess the ability to work collaboratively with others utilizing modern technologies, maybe on a global scale? How do we assess those things? Time Magazine came out with this great article, December 18th. How many of you read this? A few of you. It has this money paragraph in it. I'll read it to you. For the past 5 years, the national conversation on education has focused on reading scores, math tests, and closing the achievement gap between social classes. This is not a story about that conversation. This is a story about the big public conversation the nation is not having about education, the one that will ultimately determine not merely whether some fraction of our children get left behind, but also whether an entire generation of kids will fail to make the grade in the global economy because they can't think their way through abstract problems, work in teams, distinguish good information from bad, or speak a language other than English. Let me talk quickly about the not-so-hidden revolution, the move that we've seen on the web from Web 1.0 to Web 2.0. What do I mean by that? Well, when web pages first came around, they were pretty static. You couldn't interact with them, right? It was basically pushing information out. You had to go find what you wanted. Some big media entity or corporation or organization was pushing information out. And we as individuals also had the ability to create web pages, but you had to know how to code. You had to be a programmer, literally. And you had to figure out how to FTP stuff up to some space so that you could get your page up there. And a lot of people said, you know what? That's too much hassle. That's too hard. I don't want to be a programmer. So we were passive consumers of what others delivered to us over the web. And what we've seen happen in just the past 3 to 5 years, literally, is a movement towards what people call Web 2.0, where the idea is that now we're putting the power into the hands of the users rather than the entities. So our new technologies are allowing us to collaborate. Think about things like not only email, but instant messaging and video conferencing, where you know I can download my free Skype software, and with my $50 webcam, I can connect and talk directly with somebody in, you know, Tokyo or Afghanistan or Prague or whatever. No problem. And we have all these other tools that allow us to collaborate, shared workspaces, etc. The creativity is just burgeoning as these tools get pushed down to the person on the street. You know, you no longer have to be a publishing company to be able to make and print a book and get it out there and disseminate and sell it. You no longer have to be a recording studio to make a record album. You no longer have to have access to a recording studio because now you can, you know, use GarageBand on your Macintosh and go to town. You no longer need to be a movie studio to make a digital movie. You know, you can buy a $300 digital web camcorder, and off you go. And so what we're seeing is that when we put these tools in the hands of the users, they use them, and they take advantage of them. And so we're seeing a lot of disintermediation where the entities that used to control access to these tools and had the reach and scope to reach people, we're now able to bypass them, right? We're able to bypass the studios and reach our potential audience directly through web tools, et cetera. So the reach is now unprecedented. You know, somebody can set up a blog, and if it catches and people are interested in it, you can literally reach 20, 30, 40,000 people every single day all over the globe without having to go through anybody. It's just you and them in a direct conversation. And so we're talking about the tools like wikis and blogs and podcasts and online video tools like YouTube and online photo sharing tools like Flickr and social bookmarking tools like Delicious and social news sites like Dig and mapping sites like Google Maps, where they open up their programming interface and let everybody in the world have access to it and say, how can you add value to this? Right? MySpace, 106 million users. Why is MySpace so popular? Because it does one thing extremely effectively. It allows people to communicate with each other at an unprecedented level. So in the old days, our teenagers, they'd be on the phone, and you'd be like, get off the phone. They'd say, Mom, leave me alone. I'm talking to my friend. And now that's inefficient, right? Because that's only one-to-one. But in MySpace, I can type up 3 paragraphs, or I can record a little video or movie, and I can send it out instantly to 9,500, 300 people, and they all know. And I'm getting back, and I'm part of this interconnected network. Telephone, forget it. All right. So we've got these online role-playing games where teenagers and adults. They're in there and they're interacting in these literally these virtual worlds where they have complete autonomy and they're able to be self-directed and independent and work together with people all over the globe to solve problems in creative ways. And then some of these companies, they're taking these video games that these kids are playing, and again, they're opening up the interfaces and letting people modify them. So we even see companies taking advantage of this. So for example, see if I can find this one, Shell Oil. They took the gaming interface for Quake, which is a first-person shooter game. You know, you go around and you shoot up stuff. And they modified that to turn into an oil rig training scenario. So they modified the underlying code a little bit and the graphics, and now you can go in, and instead of simulating going around and shooting up people, you're on an oil rig, and you're training their workers on how to handle safety problems and navigate the different areas before they ever set foot on a rig. And so one of the things we're seeing with the web is that it's interconnected, it's collaborative, it's personalized, right? We can personalize it to fit our needs and our interests. It's autonomous, it's very freewheeling, and it's also very empowering. Now look at that list of words and think about how many of those words describe the classrooms in your school organization. And yet that's what the kids have when they go home. This is scary. A lot of this is very scary. And so Warlick, he's such a great quote guy, he says, "Education believes in containers. The new information landscape operates without containers. This scares us to death. For how many years or months or days is the MySpace nation going to allow us to put their learning into containers?" The week after Time came out with this issue about building students for the 21st century, they came out with this issue, their Person of the Year issue. And guess who the Person of the Year is? It's you. Take a look. There you are. And actually, it may or may not be you. What they talked about is the you are the people who are taking advantage of these technologies and are being empowered by this new technology-suffused, globally interconnected world that we're living in, right? Because what the technologies are allowing us to do is allowing us to control not only our information, but our world and how we interact with folks. But in schools, technology is still seen as an add-on, as something that's optional, and thus it gets marginalized in the grand scheme of things. So again, the question becomes, are schools teaching the right things? And Clarence Fisher says that incrementally changing our teaching methods, slowly bringing people up to speed, worked fine when ideas of literacy and education weren't rapidly changing, but now they are. And we need to somehow be able to leapfrog in our understandings and our methods and our tools so that we can move to where the kids already are. If we don't become leaders to our students, then we will be followers. We're going to be seen as irrelevant, crying in our books. While we teach whatever we teach at school, the kids go home to learn the skills they need to survive and prosper in an interconnected global economy. We're starting to recognize that video games are not brain-rotting waste of times, but actually are highly charged learning environments. So we have academics like Jim Gee, who talks about what video games have to teach us about learning and literacy. We have David Schaefer, how computer games help children learn. And of course, Mark Prensky, "Don't bother me, Mom, I'm learning." And what we're learning about these games is that there's some cognitive stuff that's happening here that we need to somehow tap into, because the kid who cannot sit still for 5 minutes in school can be locked in for hours at home playing these games. Why? Because there's some cognitive stuff that the game is doing with that kid. So for example, the game is set up to encourage active, not passive learning. The kids are always doing. They're always involved. They're not just sitting there passively receiving information. It's a safe space where they can take risks. Right, the safety there is fine. The environments are compelling, so compelling that they never want to stop. And why are they so compelling? Well, one reason is because they get lots of non-boring practice. And another reason is because games are designed to operate in what Vygotsky called the zone of proximal development. So they're not so hard that you give up. They're not so easy that you get bored. But they're right in your own zone of optimal challenge, right? They're just a little bit ahead of you, but you can see that with just a little bit of effort, you can get there. But of course, when you get there, the game moves a little bit in front, and now you say, oh, with just a little bit of effort, I can get there. And of course, then the game moves a little in front, and you say, oh, with a little bit of effort, I can get right there. And the next thing you know, it's 6 hours, and you've missed dinner, and your mom's like, that kid needs to go to bed. And he said, you know, the game is addictive, and it's addictive, but it's addictive in a learning sense. The kid is always learning. He's always going to the next level. He's always mastering the new skill. And do we get that in school? Do we get that individualized learning mechanism? And good games are designed to address each kid's individual learning needs at an optimal level. So if you're a novice game player, your game is different than if you're an expert game player. If you'd like to solve this problem using method A, the game will challenge you by forcing you to do method B until you get good at that too, because you need both A and B for the next level, which is when you'll also then learn method C. Maybe you are good at method B, it'll start challenging you with method A until you learn both, because in order to get to the next level, you have to learn both of those, because then you'll learn method C. And the games are, the artificial intelligences are designed to do that. And so Prensky has this article called Engage Me or Enrage Me, where he talks about the fact that at home, kids are immersed in these individualized, personalized learning environments. And then they come to school where they're in a class of 25, 30 or more, and it's being taught right down the middle. And for most of the kids, that class is not designed to their own individualized learning path. And when I'm talking about games, I'm not talking about games like this. This is what educators think about when they think of games. You know, they look like this, or this, or this. And what we're talking about is games that look like this. Or this, or this. We have the graphics technology now to literally simulate past or present worlds, future worlds, the inside of the atom, chemical forces. So you can imagine scenarios now where we can create educational games where we can literally simulate, for example, ancient Egypt. And rather than reading a few pages in a book about ancient Egypt and maybe seeing a couple pictures, and maybe if you're lucky watching a short video from the Discovery Channel, that now you can literally be in ancient Egypt as if you were a part of ancient Egypt, and you could be the pharaoh, or you could be the slave pushing the stone block, or you could be the farmer, or you could be the local merchant, or whatever. And you're making authentic decisions as if you lived in that environment, and it looks and sounds and pretty much kind of feels real to you because of the graphical technique, and the entire time the artificial intelligence is working in the background to work at your own customized, individualized learning pace. And that's the power we have. Now, yes.
Have there been studies and things on there? I want to say that all of the research in my own but when I sense that two boys and a girl, my daughter and her friends, who's now a freshman in college, none of them are gamers. They didn't play video games.
The girls.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't do that. Now the boys are all over.
That's changing.
And the boys, for age, video games.
Yeah. Yeah, that's changing.
All the females she hung out with, all of them, none of them were. Mm-hmm. That's what my question was. How does that impact this, and is that changing?
Yeah. It is changing because what we're seeing is that some of the most popular online games, for example, are not actually the ones that we would say might appeal to boys. They're not the sort of the shoot 'em up action adventure games. They're things that sort of simulate life, so like Second Life, where you can go in, or The Sims. You know, where you can go in and you're sort of, the emphasis is on relationships and communication, not on destroying things. So I think we're seeing a shift in that. So I think most of the younger kids, so Wesley Fryer talks about the fact that the kids today are what Prensky calls digital natives. All right, they're literally immersed in the technology. It's an extension of their brain, it's an extension of their bodies. It makes no sense to them when you take it away. Those of us who didn't grow up with it, most of us are immigrants to this world. We're trying to move in there and figure out, what is this all about? How do we navigate? It's like being plunked into the middle of Tibet. You're looking around going, I don't know where I am. I don't know where I should go. I don't speak the language. I don't know how to get from here to there, right? And so we have some folks, and I'd probably put myself in this category, that are bridges, that are helping immigrants somehow interact with and understand this world of the natives. Then we have the refugees, the people who are hoping they will all go away, pretending it doesn't exist. Right? We have some of those folks, too, in every organization. And then we have a few folks who are not quite sure what they're doing. So how do we avoid irrelevance? How do we, as educators, figure this stuff out? Well, let me tell you. We have over 14,000 school districts in this country. We have approximately 125,000 public and private schools in this country. Most of them are really struggling with this stuff, to be honest. As Gwynne Dyer notes, innovation is cumulative and the rate of change accelerates. We thus find ourselves continually trying to accommodate new realities within inappropriate existing institutions. And we're trying to think about those new realities in traditional but sometimes dangerously irrelevant terms. Will Richardson says that the kids who start school today will be retiring in the year 2065. We know as little about what the world will look like then as we do 5 years from now. Remember, the internet is only 10 years old. We can give them all the content we want, but in this age, it won't make much difference if we don't teach them how to learn first. And they don't do that by spitting back at us what they know. They do it by being creative, by trying and failing, by succeeding and reflecting. A couple more notches in the school is irrelevant belt, he says. Because schools change. They're not static institutions, as they're sometimes accused, right? We change in schools. But the pace of change outside of schools is much, much greater. That gap is widening, not closing. We are struggling to keep up with this stuff. And corporations and governments and other entities are also struggling to keep up. But we're behind them. They've managed to allocate some resources and have done some mindset changes, and they're doing better at keeping up than most school organizations are. Jack Welch, the former CEO of GE, has said, when the rate of change outside exceeds the rate of change inside, the end is in sight. And so it seems to me that for us, we can either start taking care of this and start trying to react and adapt and change to this new world, or somebody else is going to take care of it for us via external mandate. And I think we're starting to learn that lesson because of No Child Left Behind. Seth Godin, I love this guy. Principals, superintendents, parents, state officials, federal politicians, and yes, universities. They all say, oh, I can't, this is so too much change, I can't handle it. And Godin says, what choice do you have? So you're too extreme, this is crazy. You say, you know what, I'm a realist, this is reality. This is what's occurring out there, whether you like it or not, it's there. So we have to somehow change faster, because our approach right now is that we're here, and we say, oh, we'll get a few teachers on board this year, and a few more teachers on board next year, and a few more teachers on board the year after that. We're doing these incremental improvements, and we really need to be way over here. The shift has already occurred outside. We're just trying to catch up, but we think we're going to do it with incremental improvements, and basically we've got this big frickin' wall in the way. And as Miguel Gulen, the instructional technologist for San Antonio, says, nobody jumps a 20-foot chasm in two 10-foot jumps. When the world changes so fast that we have no reasonable way to forecast what it will look like in a mere decade or two, all we can do is teach kids how to be adaptive, to be learners in the truest sense of the word. We've always talked about preparing lifelong learners in schools, but our practices typically haven't matched our rhetoric. It's time to put some bite into our toothless vision statements and recognize that we have to teach kids how to learn to learn if they want to be successful in this new technology-suffused, globally interconnected world that they're going to be living in and working in. This is what schools can't do. We need leaders, not managers. We need folks who are anticipatory rather than reactionary. And I see a lot of school districts that are reactionary. They're compliance-oriented, NCLB, rather than being anticipatory or proactive. We need folks that are future-oriented rather than compliance-oriented. I started this presentation by quoting music star Bob Dylan. I'll end with a quote from indie rocker Liz Phair. She asks, what does it mean when something changes how it's always been? I think we need more schools that are talking about the possible answers to that question. We need more schools that recognize that they can't continue to treat technology as something that's optional rather than an essential core of the basic educational enterprise. We need more schools discussing how to balance current demands related to testing basic skills in an accountability environment with the concurrent and more important need to be relevant to the future world in which our students will be working and living. My name is Dr. Scott McCloud. I'm the director of CASEL, the only center in the country dedicated to the technology leadership needs of school administrators. Thank you. That's the web address that's on your handout. It's where you can access all these materials. I'm going to indulge my speaker privilege and show you one more 90-second video, and then we'll open up for discussion.